This is lecture 29.
We are talking about quantization of constrained systems.
We briefly reviewed the Dirac method. We briefly reviewed the method of Fadeyev. I want to conclude a little bit about the general Fadeyev or Dirac method as follows. If you're dealing with a constraint such as let's just make it a function of Q, we'll have two Q's to deal with, and we'll say that Q1 squared plus Q2 squared equals 1. So if I imagine Q1 and Q2 in an axis, in a plane rather, then I would have a circle here of radius 1. When I come to deal with the Dirac prescription, and I'm looking at the physical subspace where these will be zero, I am after a set of vectors, Q1 and Q2, I might say, would be the general diagonalization of the, so Qj on Q1, Q2, would be little qj times q1, q2. It's a joint eigenvector for both of those. I would like this to be approximately zero. I say approximately because it's not a vector in the Hilbert space. And what that means really is that if the physics of the cubes, of the labels, of your states, means or is equal to equals sharp eigen values of your operators, then it's quite natural that the range of the Q's will be restricted. The range of the Q's will be restricted. Here, I would imagine they would be restricted so that the Q1 and the Q2 would live on this circle. Likewise, in the Fadeyev prescription, so this is more like Dirac, in the Fadeyev prescription, where he's talking about a path integral, I won't write it all out, not interested so much in the shape of the path integral, I'm more interested in the nature of the variables involved in which the propagator goes from initial time 0 to final time capital T and starts at position Q prime and goes to position Q double prime, where this may stand for several coordinates as well as this one standing for several coordinates. But the physical meaning, as we have seen previously, is that these correspond to sharp eigen values of the label of the vectors, because this is indeed the propagator written this way between the bra Q double prime e to the minus Hamiltonian T divided by H bar and the ket Q prime. So the Q's would be restricted. Q's set is restricted on introducing the constraints. And that's a mere consequence, or I put it this way, it follows from the fact that the Q's are indeed
telling you how what is the range of the variables of the theory. And if those if that range is being restricted by the constraint, then so too must the labels.
Well, this introduces some kind of difficulty over here. Let's take a look at that. We can certainly represent as C numbers Q1 as cosine theta and Q2 as sine theta. That would satisfy our classical version of this particular kind of constraint. And so it might be natural to pass the states Q1, Q2 down, if you will, to a subset of those kind of states where you label the first one by cosine theta and the second one by sine theta. Let's see what that does for us or what danger that leads to. The identity operator in the original Hilbert space, before we have made any reductions for this little example, could be decomposed in terms of this conventional resolution of unity. The idea now is that if I live on this subset of variables, subset of those states, that there's some weight function W of theta here, I can imagine accompanying d theta, that would give me a I, or the unit operator, say, in the physical Hilbert space. Or put it another way, a projection operator in the big space. Let's just check if this is going to work. If that is the identity up here, the first line, then identity squared should be identity. And that comes when I take these two of these and multiply them together, dq1, dq2. My second family I'll call q1 prime, q2 prime, q1 prime, q2 prime, dq1 prime, dq2 prime. That bracket coming together, we know, gives me a delta function of the q1s and a delta function of the q2s. And I can use that delta function of the two variables to eliminate this family over here. And so I would be left with q1, q2. These would be forced to become the labels q1, q2, and that would be the only integration of variables left over dq1, dq2. And indeed, I have established that is a resolution of unity. Let's see what happens with the second case. I'm going to multiply two of these together. If that's an identity, it will become an identity. If that's a projection operator, it should be a projection operator. It should be the reproduce itself again. So let's do that. Cosine theta minus sine theta ket. Cosine theta sine theta bra. W of theta d theta. And now do it again. Cosine theta prime sine theta prime. Cosine theta prime sine theta prime. W of theta prime d theta prime. The overlap of these is given to us because these are the same vectors as these, just a subset of those vectors. So that will become a delta of cosine theta minus cosine theta prime times a delta of sine theta minus sine theta prime. That takes care of this inner product right here. And what we have left is our cosine theta, sine theta to begin with, and our cosine theta prime, sine theta prime, w of theta prime, d theta prime. It would look straightforward to use these delta functions to bring those two together. But there's only one variable. Over here, when Q1 and Q1 prime came together. I did not force these guys in the second delta function to come together. They were independent arguments in the delta function. Over here, that's not the case. When cosine theta becomes equal to cosine theta prime, there's a 50-50 chance that sine theta will equal sine theta prime. So this one will become infinity at the time this theta is happening. So this one does not equal I again. What does that mean? It means that in this kind of business, if you're going to insist on using your labels as eigenvalues of your basic operators, which is our convention, which is our tradition in quantum mechanics, you're going to have to do something else. You're going to have to define new vectors labeled by that same theta, the theta which is parameterizing our variables, the theta which is going in the classical variables around the circle and distinguishing the physically distinct points. You're going to have to define new vectors, perhaps with a wave function here as well, d theta, and that will become your I. If these are delta normalized, then that w theta can be chosen to be 1. So this will be your new projection operator onto the proper subspace, or if you like, your identity in the physical Hilbert space. That is a significant complication. And I draw your attention to it because the method I want to talk about now superficially appears to use the variables that we've been using before. We're going to use P and Q again, but thanks to the coherent states, they do not, I emphasize again, they do not mean sharp eigenvalues. They are expectation values. So they do not need to follow this same kind of business we've been talking about here.
Could you repeat again this I, the second one, call it something fizz?
Okay, so the question is, what do I mean here?
Yeah, exactly.
I have a physical subspace contained in my original physical sub-Hilbert space, contained in my original Hilbert space. This is the subspace, as Dirac would have us say, on which the constraints are satisfied. That set of vectors, last time we were together, we actually called this psi, an element, PHYS, physical, belonging to that Hilbert space, which was set equal to 0. Here, it was in the 0 eigenspace of this. If I have two such vectors, I can add them, so they make a linear vector space. Close it because it's a self-adjoint operator, you get a sub-Hilbert space. That's all that means here. Okay. And that symbol should be the same as here as well. Call it H by H. Okay, so I want to turn your attention now to a different prescription. Can I take my papers away? No. A prescription which, in my opinion, solves both the problems of the second class constraints, which we've seen before, and it will also deal with this situation when we have a operator with continuous spectrum and no form, no true eigenvectors in the Hilbert space. This is called the projection operator method. From 1997 by myself, although there are some earlier hints, let's put it that way, some earlier hints by others.
So the idea here is, again, we're going to talk kinematics
for a while.
We have our classical constraints, alpha equals 1 up to capital A. These are real functions of the phase space variables, which again we will assume are in sufficiently good Cartesian coordinates that I can promote those to operators themselves. We will get our constraint operators, and I will assume these are self-adjoint. So that means they are Hermitian in the usual sense, plus they will generate unitary transformations. Normally, we would like these to be zero, and we do that in the classical theory. We can do that in the classical theory. Perhaps we should close the door. We got one person going. Wait. We can do that in the classical theory. As we've seen, we can't quite do it in the quantum theory. In particular, for the second class constraints, that's simply not going to be satisfactory. And I hope to give you a better understanding of that situation. I want to build out of these constraints a particular combination. I want to take the sum of the squares of those constraint operators, alpha equals 1 to capital A, and sometimes I'll just abbreviate that combination by capital X. Whatever the spectral values of the phi are, this quantity will certainly be greater than or equal to 0 because it's the sum of squares. And I want to make a projection operator, which I call E with a bar through it, on the spectrum of X that is less than some numerical factor, delta squared, depending on H bar. That will be times the identity operator. I will typically not write that. So this can be explained in several ways. I will take the operator X, which we've agreed is greater than or equal to zero. I will put this projection operator on either side of it. And then I tell you that this operator is bounded by delta squared of H bar times the identity. One other way of writing it, X will be a self-adjoint operator. There is a spectral family, so-called. I'll write that in a more formal way. You'll see that what that means in a minute. When I integrate that lambda, and that operator X could have spectrum from 0 to infinity. In our traditional physicist way of writing that, we would write that as lambda, lambda, d lambda. Although that makes it look like it has a continuous spectrum, we might have a discrete spectrum alternatively. This mathematical looking formula incorporates both the continuous and the discrete. Beg your pardon, that's up to infinity. And what I want to now do is have the projection operator to be a representation of that only up to the value delta squared lambda. So I just thrown away all spectral components of X higher. So we're going to focus on this, and I'm going to give you a few quick examples to get some handle on it. So example one is our rotation generator. So the phi alpha are our JKs, and that they satisfy, you remember, JI. Now let's do with a J. JK, I, epsilon, JKL, JL. So they satisfy the typical rules for SO3. They are our regular rotation operator generators. Capital J squared, the sum of the J squareds, that will be my capital X for this example. And we know
from our studies of quantum mechanics.
What are the spectral possibilities of this? They are J times summation J times J plus 1 times H bar squared, sum from J equals 0 up to infinity, times a projection operator, we'll do it with an E with a curl over it, onto the subspace belonging to spin J.
If I say that J squared as an operator should be less than 1 half H bar squared, and I project onto that subspace, then I am insisting,
by the way, this is half integer sums, not integer sums,
that I am insisting that I only include elements that in this space for which this sum here is 1 half h bar squared or less. Well, a 0 will satisfy that. 0 for j will make that 0. That's less than that. But the first spin possible is 1 half times 3 halves. That's 3 quarters. 3 quarters h bar squared is larger than that. So this excludes the all other spins, and this then is a projection operator onto the values where j squared is identically 0. I can do that because this operator j squared has a distinct, discrete spectrum, 0, 3 quarters h bar squared, 2 h bar squared, and so on. All right. Let's look at example 2. Is phi 1 equal to p, phi 2 equal to q. This is the typical second class example. So my x operator is the sum of those squares. That's p squared plus q squared. You recognize that operator. It looks like the harmonic oscillator, or twice the Hamiltonian. So the spectrum of x here is h bar, 3 h bar. Notice this is not divided by 2 for your normal Hamiltonian, so everything gets doubled, 5 h bar, and so on. So if I project x less than 1 half h bar, or sorry, less than or equal to h bar, then I will pick up exactly that particular value. So this becomes a projection operator onto the lowest or ground state situation, states. In particular, it's all of those vectors psi for which q plus ip equals 0. I don't write it exactly as the harmonic oscillator ground state as a single state, because that would assume that the Q's and P's are irreducible. This could be part of a family of other P's and Q's in a particular problem. And then a single P and a single Q would not then be irreducible for the whole Hilbert space. But nevertheless, this situation is true. There might be many vectors for which this is true, depending on, say, the other degrees of freedom. Okay. So I want you to make an observation here that this capital X here has a discrete spectrum which includes 0. This capital X here has a discrete spectrum which does not include 0. This is the second class situation. Example. And this is the first class example. And in my opinion, this provides a clear-cut distinction in this particular case when you have a discrete spectrum between the first class and the second class situations.
second class situations, if I said that Ex here was less than or equal to 1/2 h bar, then I could not even capture this little guy, and I would have a zero here. So that's why no solutions according to the original Dirac prescription, and we showed that perhaps the very last time we were together. Example three I want to talk about is simply one constraint equal to q. So my x is q squared, and my projection is onto q squared less than or equal to delta squared. Now, q has a continuous spectrum. So no matter how small I make this delta, and I keep it finite, there will be some spectral region connected. And the projection operator that I get out of that will be actually onto an infinite dimensional space, no matter how small but finite the delta is. If I try to make delta equal zero, goes to zero, then E projected onto Q squared equals zero is again the zero factor. I like to draw these kind of projection operators in a graphical picture. On the vertical axis, I'm putting the projection operator. At the bottom down here is the zero operator, which also is a projection operator. Here's my parameter delta squared. Let's look at the first class situation here. And imagine the delta squared here being rather large, so I might capture several spin values. And then as I decrease it, the spin values will become not included. But even as I get down toward the bottom of that, for every finite value of delta, that is, there will be still the values at zero that I captured. So what I'm trying to argue here, qualitatively speaking, is that I come down here, as delta gets smaller, my E will get smaller, but I will go to some particular E even as delta goes to zero. So this is the first class situation. The second class situation is, as delta is very large, delta squared large, I might capture several of these eigenvalues of our harmonic oscillator. And as delta gets smaller, I will lose some of those. But finally, I get to something. And then when delta gets below that, I get nothing at all. And that's the picture that looks like this. I go down there, and at a finite delta, I lose everything. I go to the zero operator. So this is the second class situation. This third guy here, the space is getting smaller. Well, the space is getting to be a subset of the previous spaces as we go down in delta, getting likewise small. But as I went to zero, I would actually lose the projection operator altogether. So here is the continuous spectrum situation. Here, if I stop at h bar as my lowercase, I will get a satisfactory answer. Here, if I choose any number smaller than 3/4 h bar squared, I'm happy with the answer. Over here, I go down toward this delta going to zero, and if I literally go to the zero, it will disappear. In particular, if I take a state, and here we're going to talk about right now how we can go to the limit delta equal to zero. So let's briefly talk about that. So here is E of phi squared, q squared, less than or equal to delta squared, psi. If I put that into the representation which diagonalizes q, then that would be the function phi of x, phi star of x. I'm leaving a space, you'll see why. Psi of x, leave a space, I have a dx. Except now due to this projection operator, I am limiting myself between plus delta and minus delta. The space is there,
because I might have other variables in the problem. There may be degeneracy. So I could put a y here as a second variable, integration dy, to account for degeneracy in particular. And let's imagine that that dy is plus to minus infinity. Now you can see that the limit as delta goes to zero here will literally go to zero, because these are square integrable functions, and I am taking them over a shrinking range, and that will go to zero. So intuitively, what I would like to do is to expand or enlarge what's happening here. I want to look at, as this gets smaller, I want to magnify that. So I'm going to now, there's no equality here, I'm going to divide by the breadth, the width of that, 2 delta, and then talk about that limit as delta goes to zero, because the limit up here, delta going to zero, disappears. Phi star xy psi of xy dx dy. Unfortunately, that's not a good question to ask. And here's an example of why. Yes?
So these were just for our specific examples. Is there any sort of generalization we can draw from these operator functions for all first class and second class constraints?
So the question is, does my picture correspond to generalized situations?
Yeah.
Qualitatively, I would say yes. I could add a first class constraint situation to a second class constraint. Suppose these operators were independent of that operator. Then I would have my projection operator on these guys less than some delta squared of h bar capital I. Okay, now I would say that we want to have the zero situation here. I must have the h bar here, so I have an h bar for that, plus three quarters minus, I don't have that in my head, the answer to your question, but see, this is a mixed combination of the two, and I think it would bear out some choice, perhaps, but I can't do it right now. Okay, so I'm trying to explain why, while this is a nice idea, you want to magnify things, you can't do it quite straight away. And here's the reason. Suppose I chose a function phi of x and y, which was equal to 1 over x to the 1 quarter in magnitude, times e to the minus x squared plus y squared. This function would satisfy the criterion to be in the Hilbert space, because it would be a square integrable function. Dx dy is finite, because that's an integrable singularity. On the other hand, as I would take the limit as delta went to zero, 1 over 2 delta, integral from plus to minus infinity on y, plus to minus delta on x, of this e to the minus x, well, e to the minus, okay, phi of xy star, this particular example, same phi xy here, dx dy, I would get an infinity because this would be evaluating this thing at phi of 0 and y absolute squared dy. And that value is infinity because of that x, singularity. So I have to back off. And this is a caution and a treatment that is common to many procedures. I back off. Do not look at arbitrary vectors or functions in our particular case.
but rather a dense set of smooth functions. For example, call them phi sub zero. They could be in the set of functions which are polynomials in x and y times nice Gaussians. That set of functions is dense in the Hilbert space. And let me restrict not only my phi to that, but my psi zero as well. And then I am free to raise the question about the limiting behavior when I deal with restricted class of functions of that type. Limit delta to zero. Now I can bring the limit inside. I can go to x equals zero for our integrand. That is not a problem because I'm dealing with such nice functions here. The answer will be, in fact, exactly given by phi zero of at point zero times y complex conjugate, psi sub zero at zero at value of x, y dy from plus to minus infinity. The only thing that is not true now is I have an incomplete Hilbert space. I do not have all the possible functions that could be here. So this is what's called a sesquilinear form. So I must complete the new Hilbert space. Now I'll call it new here. This becomes my inner product. In my new Hilbert space, I'll call it angle-angle phi 0 psi 0 angle-angle. It has a different rule for integration because there's now there's one variable less. The x is gone. This inner product will define a norm, and in that norm, I use Cauchy sequences to complete the Hilbert space in the standard way. Okay, that's called changing the Hilbert space.
And that's how.
This looks like a code.
Like a what?
Code. I mean.
C O
R E. I mean, if you the only
core. C O R E.
Yeah. The only the minimal extension would make it the whole Hilbert space.
So this the comment was that looks like a core, and a core is attributed to a certain operator.
Yeah. So. For example, the Hamiltonian.
Well, some Hamiltonians, but this might be a core. I agree, I grant you, but not all. It's a convenient dense set. It's not all functions. It's a convenient dense set. And there's nothing magic about this choice. I could have divided by two up here, had a completely different set of functions except for the zero element. They would have been just as good to use for this purposes as well. Okay, any further questions? Yes?
Did you say that dense set is not complete? That dense set is not complete.
So this dense set is not every function in the Hilbert space. But I can take elements of this set here, a sequence of such elements, and I can pass to an arbitrary element in my Hilbert space by taking this so-called limit in the mean as n goes to infinity. That would become zero. These functions can be made arbitrarily close to this and pass to that in the limit. Okay. What is an observable in this language? We're going to use the E operator, the projection operator, to take us from the original Hilbert space down to a subset which we will define to be the physical Hilbert space. Now, E depends on delta, and we may have not chosen our delta optimally yet. So this physical subspace will depend on delta. And the part of the game is to choose the least delta that you can get away with, for example. What about observables? What's the characteristic feature of an observable? Well, we talked about this previously. Observables should take a vector in the physical Hilbert space and leave it in the physical Hilbert space. Since this observable is Hermitian, it follows that this operator has, as we saw this structure before, let's call it O1 and O2 today, depending on our breakup into our physical Hilbert space and into our Hilbert space orthogonal to that. There are zeros up here. Since the projection operator E will project me from vectors in the whole Hilbert space to vectors that live only in the physical Hilbert space, it means that an observable O has the property that it commutes with the projection operator. Property to be an observable.
John,
question.
Notational question. You have the H physical and then another H.
Orthogonal. H perpendicular, orthogonal to it.
Could read the sum.
I got you. The sum of those two being the total Hilbert space. And in this region, E acts as unity. In this region, E acts as zero. Okay. Let's start a little discussion about first class systems. Dealing with the projection operator approach. Now, there's a very interesting thing about the first class systems. You recall, in the classical theory, the lambda alphas were undetermined, meaning the equations of motion did not fix the lambdas for you. You had to do that yourself. Choice of gauge in order to get a true solution to the problem. We saw, for example, one of the conditions for that to be true was that the Poisson bracket of phi alpha with the classical Hamiltonian vanished on the constrained hypersurface, or we could say that that was a linear combination of the constraints themselves, which would then vanish on the constrained surface, hypersurface. That was also true for the constraints with the constraint. That was their characteristic feature. Again, some constants perhaps on C. It meant that phi dot, the derivative of phi alpha, was automatically zero provided phi was zero. That means that you were on the hypersurface. Let's continue then. Phi double dot can be analyzed in the same way. And since phi dot involves this ingredient and this ingredient, it's just a linear combination of the phis, and it's back to the very first question. So this one will also be zero, provided you are on C. Characteristic of first class systems. And of course, this goes on for arbitrarily many derivatives equal to zero. What that means is that if you satisfy the constraints phi alpha pq equal to zero at time zero as part of your initial data, as part of your initial data, then phi alpha p of q equals zero holds automatically for all time. The equations of motion will guarantee it. That means all you have to do is impose that first. That has a name. That's called the initial value equation. That does not happen for second class constraints. They are qualitatively different. We'll come back to that when we entertain the second class constraints. The same story holds in the quantum theory. Namely, if you start in the physical Hilbert space, in which the constraints then are effectively satisfied, then your dynamical evolution will keep you in the physical Hilbert space. So on quantization of first class systems, the initial value equation persists, if you will. That's because in the operator theory, you had to deal with these two ingredients, the analog of the classical Poisson brackets. Now we have two commutators, phi alpha with the Hamiltonian, phi alpha with another constraint, phi beta. These are zero on the physical Hilbert space. And therefore, the linear sum of these, with suitable coefficients, says that the time derivative of alpha p of q will be zero in the physical Hilbert space. And again, more time derivatives, all satisfy that criterion. So all you need to do is put yourself in the physical Hilbert space to begin with, and the dynamics will keep you there. In quantum theory, start at p equal to zero with states psi in the physical Hilbert space, and the dynamics will keep you there. Just to say it one more time in another way, in the classical theory, you only have to impose the constraints once at a single time. I'm offering that time at time equal to zero. Of course, it didn't really matter that it was time equal to zero. It could be halfway through your propagation or at the end. But time equals zero is a natural thing, especially if you want to use the word initial value. Similarly for the quantum theory, all you have to do is input your restriction, your projection operator, once into the system at the beginning of your calculation, and then that will carry forth. Maybe I should take another minute here to say that in the first class system situation,
the Hamiltonian isn't observable. So it commutes with E. Therefore,
this is not in general true, but this is the first class situation. Therefore, the most complicated thing you could imagine, that you insist on having a projected Hamiltonian operator as your generator for time translations, and that you insist on starting in the physical subspace and ending in the physical subspace. Those are all those E's there. This is identical to propagation by itself with one E at the initial time. And the reason for that is if you expand that out in a power series, you can move all the E's straight away through it because they commute with the H to the one over here, and since E squared equals E, you collect them over there. So here is the initial value idea, initial value equation. You impose it once and propagate, ignoring the constraint thereafter, and that is equivalent to having restricted your Hamiltonian to the subspace, propagating with this restriction at the beginning as well as at the end. Okay. End of lecture. See you next time.